Welcome to Rebel Tales. I'm your host, Dwayne Crowley. Thank you to everybody who's listened to the podcast so far and offered any kind of advice and feedback on it. Today is officially episode 2, although I released a bonus episode last weekend, and that covered the executions from the 1916 Rising. I know that there was a fictional piece that I drew in there that was included in the Trial of Padraic Pearse TV show, and that seems to have really resonated with people. Because it really got across what it would be like from the British perspective if they lost the war to Germany during World War One, and put in context of what Ireland was going through, it was a real justification on some levels for the Easter Rising when applied to the leaders of 1916. Today I want to do the first in a two-part series on Kilmichael. Now, if anybody is from Cork or West Cork in particular, I'm sure the Kilmichael ambush has been something that you've heard about from childhood. But we usually only get the facts and the figures, and we hear about Tom Barry and a couple of others. But I want to give a more balanced picture of what happened, and balanced in the way that I want to today name all of those 46 men who took part in the Kilmichael ambush. Some of them have absolutely incredible stories. I have a book here called The Wild Heather Glen, The Kilmichael Story of Grief and Glory. And this is put together by the Kilmichael and Crossbarry Commemoration Committee in 2005. And I have to say, it's one of the absolute gems of history in West Cork. If you want to get your hands on a copy of this, and I highly recommend you do, I know that they sell it in Bandon Books, which is in the shopping centre in Bandon. And I think they sell it at some of the commemorations there for the Crossbarry ambush and the Kilmichael ambush. But it's an incredibly well-researched book that you can tell can only come out of local knowledge. And what it does is it names all 46 men who fought at Kilmichael. I just want to read all of their names, and this book is absolutely fantastic in the way that it actually has some pictures of the men, some from when they were younger men, some from when they were older, and it has information about their lives. And I just want to take snippets from a few of them, because to do this book any bit of justice at all, you really do need to find a copy of it. So I think we're all indebted to the committee of the Kilmichael and Crossbarry Commemoration Committee for putting this together. It is absolutely outstanding. So sorry if you hear a bit of page rustling there, but I do like to take it from the physical copies. Some of the things too, before I start reading the names that stand out to me in particular about this, is that in some cases here, they name the reasons why these men joined the volunteers. In one case, it's because a bridge was blown up in his community and he saw the suffering of the people trying to get through. Others would have seen the horrible beatings and burnings that were going on around the place, and they wanted to play their part. But one of the more striking things about this book to me is how familiar those names are, especially if you're from Cork, and in particular West Cork for a lot of these names. They're so familiar that we're all going to know somebody with these surnames. And I think growing up, a lot of us probably would have heard that we all had a great grandfather or a great grandmother who did something during the War of Independence. But unfortunately, because of the wounds from the Civil War that carried down through the generations, a lot of these things weren't spoken about. So it's incredible that the damage that 11-month terrible Civil War did to the memories of a lot of these people. I'm going to start reading their names now, and a couple of facts about a few that stand out. But again, I don't want to read too much from the book. I do want you to go and find a copy if you're interested, because it is absolutely incredible. So, Jack Ahern, Tom Barry, Sonny Carey, who was only 18 years old at the time of the Kilmichael ambush, Neilius Cotter, who was one of the men who moved the bodies of the three men who died, two at the scene, one later, Batty Coughlin, Dennis Cronin, Sonny Dave Crowley. And here there's, in a list of volunteers found in a black and tan officer's diary, he names Sonny as Crowley, David, Sonny. Connacht commands his IRA Company took part in Kilmichael. Height around 5'9", age 32, long light brown hair, clean shaven face with a small mole on the side of the jaw, grey eyes, straight nose, high cheekbones, thin and athletic, about 11 stone, warts or pimples on face, wounded and abandoned twice. The last two words were heavily underlined. But the age was right, demonstrating the high quality of British intelligence and the IRA. So if you think about that time and what these men were trying to do, for a black and tan officer to have that kind of information, there must have been informants that knew him very, very well. And they might have informed because they were loyalists and wanted to stop anybody in the British Army getting injured or hurt. But it could have also been that that information was tortured out of their family and friends or loved ones. We just don't know. Timothy Crowley, Sean Falvey, Johnny Hegarty, Jack Hennessy. And there's actually a great testimony here from Jack Hennessy included. At 4:05 that afternoon, the first shot was fired. I had fired about 10 rounds and I got 5 bullets through the hat when a 6th bullet wounded me in the scalp. Vice Commandant McCarthy had got a bullet through the head and lay dead. I continued to load and fire, but the blood dripped from my forehead and blocked the breech of my rifle. I dropped the rifle and took up Michael McCarthy's. This was a young man who was a farmer, and he had that kind of an instinct to keep the fighting going, which is something that a paid mercenary of the auxiliaries, who I know were commissioned officers in the British Army, but they weren't fighting for the same things. Then we had Michael Herlihy, Dan Howran, Jack Howran, John Kelly, John Lorden, Jack McCarthy, Paddy McCarthy, Timothy McCarthy. A name that would be very familiar to anybody who read Guerrilla Days in Ireland or any of the other accounts of West Cork would be Jim Spud Murphy. He fought at Kilmichael, Bergeisha House, Ross Barracks, Clonakilty Barracks and the Crossbarry Ambush. John Flyer Nyan, again, it's the same, one of those names that keeps popping up. Dennis O'Brien, Paddy O'Brien, Tim O'Connell, who was actually in charge of removal of the bodies of those who died in Kilmichael. It says here, immediately after the engagement at Kilmichael, Tim was delegated the dangerous task of taking charge of the dead bodies and the young, fatally wounded Pat Deasy. For the next 5 days, while auxiliaries scoured the country, he was one of the men who secretly found medical and spiritual assistance for his dying comrade. He concealed and finally buried the dead volunteers. Michael O'Donovan from Roscarbery, Michael O'Donovan from Leppe, Patrick O'Donovan from Drimaleague, Patrick O'Donovan from Dunmanway, Dan O'Driscoll, Michael O'Driscoll, Michael Con O'Driscoll, Jerome O'Hay, James O'Mahony, Jeremiah O'Mahony. And there's a great excerpt here. Following Kilmichael, he went into hiding and didn't risk visiting or sleeping at home. He was amongst those who, some days after the ambush, took the bodies of the 3 dead volunteers to their final burial at Castletown Kenna. As they passed Ballyvillane Cross, a strange white light is said to have shone directly on Jeremiah O'Mahony. Some weeks later, before having the chance of being in charge of a unit at Crossbarry Ambush on 19th of March, he was accidentally shot dead at that very spot. He was 30 years of age. And in a couple of the accounts that I read, I think that spirituality and these omens were very well respected and not taken lightly. You have to remember too that at the time, a lot of these men were devout Catholics, mass every Sunday, parish priest, what he said was gospel, literally. So when the church excommunicated the men of these flying columns for their activities, that must have weighed very, very heavy on them. And still, a lot of them carried on the fight. There were priests too that gave them absolution and heard their confession, even though they were supposedly excommunicated from the church. And that's a story for another day. Dennis O'Neill, and not to be confused with Dennis Sonny O'Neill, who was the man who was most likely to have fired the shot that killed Michael Collins in the ambush at Ballinabloch in August 1922. Stephen O'Neill, Dennis O'Sullivan, Jack O'Sullivan. And there's one excerpt here that gives you an idea of what life was like for the men of the column and the men on the run. So while on the run, he slept in caves and dugouts in the hills and depended on the generosity of people for food. As well as Kilmichael, Jack saw action at the Gagan and Inishannon ambushes. He was part of the force that, late one night, in their stockinged feet, captured the RIC barracks at Inishannon. The sound of their boots would have caused the dogs to bark and alerted the enemy. Jack had a great respect for Tom Barry and his firm leadership of the column. He gave strict orders that there should be no drinking while on duty and did not hesitate to dismiss anyone found in breach of this rule. As a result of Barry's orders, Jack himself never drank or smoked until many years later after his guerrilla days. Eventually captured by the British, he was interned in Cork Jail. It's those small details actually that really stand out to me. That in their stocking feet, they captured the RIC barracks. They were walking around in stocking feet so that they didn't alert the dogs, who would have barked and alerted the enemy. And if you think of what these people in the flying columns went through, the cold of an Irish winter is bad enough indoors, but when you're on the run, constantly wet, constantly sleeping outside, constantly exposed. So many of these men died of exposure not long after the War of Independence. You have to remember the Spanish flu was going around too at the same time. That spread through the prisons at the time like wildfire. And a lot of these men died of TB. They died of consumption, as it was called. They died of just exposure to the elements. So when we think of those who gave their lives to the War of Independence, we have to think past just the bullet wounds. John O'Sullivan. Tim O'Sullivan, who was actually the oldest man in action that day, he was 40 years old. Jack Roach and Ned Young. And then there were the three who didn't survive it. Jim O'Sullivan. And there's a piece here I want to read about his last day when he was heading out to meet the column. On the 21st of November 1920, he was called for special training with Tom Barry's flying column. As he was leaving, his uncle Con tried to dissuade him from going, but to no avail. He was going to free Ireland, he said. He lifted his infant cousin from the cot and hugged him. Paddy, he joked, you will be reading about me in history yet, boy. Little did he know how prophetic his words would prove. The story is told of an 8-day clock in the family home, which had not worked for years. On the day Jim was shot, it again began ticking. His hurley, which he placed safely on the rafters of the loft, has remained there, untouched, to this day. And that goes back too to the superstition, like the light that shone on Jeremiah O'Mahony. These are the stories that I love. These, I suppose the reason that I call this podcast Rebel Tales, the small little details that a clock in the house started working again that day. I mean, that could have been just a story that was handed down through the family to inspire some hope that he had reached the afterlife. It could just be a story that sounded good and passed through from generation to generation. It could have just been pub talk. But that's what I love about this. We don't know, and we can't know. So the more we read of these men's lives and the women of Cumann na mBan, the more we read about their lives, the more we can understand about that era was actually like for these people, what day-to-day life in the village was like for them, what the oppression of British rule was for these people. Michael McCarthy. Even though he was young at the time of the Kilmichael ambush, he'd already led a very active life in the volunteers. And to take an excerpt here, as a volunteer officer in Dunmanway, he was on orders to stand to during the Easter Rising. Later, he kept the skeleton organisation alive while others were arrested. He himself was captured in 1917, but following the death of Thomas Ashe in Mountjoy Jail, was released in October. He was rearrested the following March. The 3rd Cork Brigade was formed in January 1919, with all members collecting the first Dáil Éireann loan and organising the boycott of Belfast goods. Michael, appointed Vice OC in June 1919, was arrested in March 1920 and sent to Belfast Jail and then Wormwood Scrubs. There, he went on hunger strike for 18 days before general release. Before he joined the Flying Column in October 1920, he was involved in the destruction of Ballygartine Barracks and the raids on Mount Pleasant Barracks and Atkins gun dealers in Dunmanway. After joining, he took part in several smaller engagements until called for training on 21st November 1920. In his native Dunmanway, a terrace of houses named Michael McCarthy Terrace commemorates this brave young volunteer who gave his life for Ireland's independence. And the youngest casualty was Pat Deasy. Pat was just 16 years old when he died at Kilmichael. And in the first episode of this podcast, I read The Road to Kilmichael, the chapter before the chapter covering the Kilmichael ambush in Tom Barry's book. And in that, it paints a very poignant picture of what could have been. Pat Deasy wasn't supposed to be there. He was sick, but he wanted to be there. He wanted to fight for Ireland. And if you're interested in that section, I'd highly recommend you going back and listening to that podcast. But to take one section from this book about Pat Deasy, there's something here that's very powerful. That minutes after the ambush, young Pat lay dying on the roadside. He did not complain of pain, but he asked for a drink of water. He put up a brave fight to stay alive, but late on the night of the November 28th, he passed away. Now, that might have gone on for a bit, but I do think it's important that those men are named and that their sacrifice for Ireland doesn't go unnoticed over 100 years on. So for the next section of the podcast, I want to read from Eve Morrison's book. Again, fantastically researched book. I think it only came out a couple of years ago. Highly recommend, if you're interested in Kilmichael and the ambush, that you do pick up a copy of this. It's so well researched and very factual. So I think that this is a good intro before we give Tom Barry's account, so that you get a greater picture of what was happening. Life and death at the bend in the road. At 3:40 p.m. on Monday, 29th of November 1920, Thomas Dolan, RIC District Inspector in Macroom, sent a telegram to John Anderson in Dublin Castle. The news was bad. 17 auxiliaries under District Inspector Craik went to two lorries patrol 3:30 p.m. yesterday, were ambushed near Kilmichael by 70 or 100 men. 15 auxiliary forces killed, one missing, one wounded and dying. Ammunition and arms taken, lorries burned. Ambush supposed to have been about 10 p.m. last night, full details not to hand. Bodies are being taken into Macroom, now other authorities informed. A later telegram from General Tudor to the Chief Secretary in London claimed that 80 to 100 attackers in khaki and steel helmets had disarmed and brutally murdered the cadets, robbing their corpses. It would subsequently transpire that the No. 2 Platoon, C Company, Auxiliary Patrol had, in fact, been 18 strong. Arthur Frederick Poole, the initially uncounted 18 men, was a black and tan who had apparently joined the patrol as a respite from his regular duties as an officer's batman. He should not have been there at all. The search patrol had found the remains of C Company a few hours earlier, about 9 miles south of Macroom in the parish of Kilmichael. The distinctive S-shaped curving stretch of that Dunmanway Road, where the ambush took place, ran through Haremount, Coolclavan, Shanacashel Neves and Shanacashel, four of the parish's 46 townlands. The search patrol entered the site from Macroom end. The road arched to the left as they approached. Off to the right, a few yards up a boreen, narrow country road, stood a farmhouse. As the patrol rounded the bend, a burnt-out 2025 Crossley tender came into view, one rear wheel half-submerged in the boggy wet of a ditch left on the road. William Thomas Barnes lay in a pool of blood a few yards from the tender. He had a gaping wound of an axilla, armpit, four other bullet wounds and a large gunshot wound in the chest inflicted after death. According to Alexander Lewis, a member of the search patrol, poor old Barnes died smiling. This was mostly likely a rictus grin, a sign of rigor mortis. Another body lay in the road a few yards distant, and as the search party continued along the curve, several more came into view. Then, about 170 yards further on, they saw a second wrecked tender near the entrance to Murray's Lane, another boreen running up to the left. Further along the road, past the first tender, lay the remains of Albert George Jones and Henry Oliver Pearson. Jones' leg was broken and his body was riddled by 7 gunshot wounds, one in the axilla. Pearson, shot in the head and the leg, also had a jagged wound in one of his forearms. Midway between the two tenders lay Frederick Henry Ford. Remarkably, despite lying on the road all night severely wounded, he was alive. Air Ministry weather reports, compiled from information supplied by diligent local observers from the Irish Rainfall Association, record that southwest Ireland was wet and unsettled on the 28th and 29th of November. The rain probably kept Ford's wounds clean and free of infection. Off the road to the left, not far from Ford, on marshy ground, near a small stream running between rocky outcrops, were Frank Taylor and William Pallister. Taylor had a perforated wound in the chest and had been shot 5 times, once with a shotgun at very close range. Pallister was shot in the chest and his head had been smashed open by an axe or some similar heavy weapon. The stream ran under the road and re-emerged on the southern side of the other end of the ambush site. Several yards back from the road on the right lay William Hooper Jones, shot in the axilla and groin. The bodies of Frederick Ulloa, Benjamin Webster and Ernest William Henry Lucas were lying around the furthest tender. Huger and Webster were a few feet apart on the boggy ground to the north. Webster had a gaping wound on his shoulder, a broken arm, and had been shot 3 times in the back with a rifle. Hugo had extensive lacerated wounds on the lower extremities and a fractured leg and skull. His wounds were thought to have been inflicted by some sort of a bomb. Lucas had been shot in the head. He also had several other wounds on his body and a broken leg. Christopher Wainwright and Poole, the black and tan, lay several yards up to the north by Murray's Lane. Both had been shot 4 times. Wainwright's twice in the back. Poole's head and face had been smashed in by a heavy, blunt instrument after that. The bodies of Francis William Craik, the platoon commander, Cyril Dunstan Wakefield Bailey, Philip Noel Graham, James Chubb Cleave, and Leonard Douglas Bradshaw were piled in 2 heaps on the gorse-covered ground on the left of the lane. Craik had died from a single gunshot to the head. Graham, shot through his neck, also had a broken leg and several lacerated wounds on his body. Bailey had been shot through the back of the head and the chest. Cleave and Bradshaw were furthest from the road. Cleave was shot in the chest and pelvis. Bradshaw, shot in the left axilla and chest, also had a broken right arm and 3 other wounds in various parts of the body. In both cases, some of the injuries had been inflicted by gunshots fired at very close range. Cecil James Guthrie was missing. According to Bill Munro, another member of the search party, the litter of corpses and debris told a grim tale. Those with no empty cartridge cases behind them were obviously hit by the first volley, and taking this as a criterion, we could envisage in what order they had died and what sort of a show they had put up. Some had been able to reload once or twice, but the number was soon reduced to 3, who must have put up a tremendous fight. There were literally hundreds of empty cases beside them. They had even fought on after being hit several times. They must have kept the enemy under cover for a comparatively long time, and it took hand grenades thrown from this cover to silence them. The locations of the lorries and the bodies, as well as the positions taken by rebel troops, were mapped by platoon commander Lieutenant Edgar Fleming. Dr. Jeremiah Kelleher, a local doctor whose RIC inspector son Philip had been killed by the Longford IRA a few weeks earlier, examined the bodies. So that chapter from Eve's book is incredibly detailed, but there's an awful lot in it that reads like an official report, but doesn't tell the full picture. And also there's just some basic untruths in it. And that's not Eve telling untruths. That was the information that the British had at the time when they're just quoting those reports, like between 80 and 100 rebels and mutilated them on the battlefield after they had died. And we know that that wasn't the case, that it was 46 volunteers, but only 16 of them were really shooting because of the availability of rifles and their position and all that. And that some of the fighting got so close that it was hand-to-hand combat. That would explain some of the more gruesome injuries that were described and possibly carried out after death. But in Tom Barry's account, which I'm about to read, we're going to learn of why some of those injuries occurred and how they happened in the moment. I do recommend picking up a copy of Eve Morrison's book on Kilmichael. It's incredibly well researched, and you can see that the detail in that is very clinical in a way. It's almost like a court report. It's almost like a medical report. And obviously there was elements of the medical reports included there by the doctor whose son, who was in the RIC, was killed by the Longford IRA. Now, the whole reason that I'm doing this podcast is to bring the voices of the people who were involved in the conflict to life. And it's all well and good to read an account like Eve Morrison's, and that gives us a full picture in some way, but it doesn't tell us what actually happened, what the men were feeling, what the men were thinking, the decisions that they had to make in the moment. That chapter from Eve's book will give us an idea of how the Oxys fought back, who was killed immediately and all the rest of it, but I want to take the account from the men who were there. Now I'm going to start with Tom Barry's account from his book Guerrilla Days in Ireland, but I'm also going to take from Liam Deasy's book, which is another fantastic publication, Towards Ireland Free. Both of these books are available from Mercier Press still, I think, and I highly, highly recommend picking up a copy. Now, in later years, there was an awful lot of controversy, and Tom Barry actually published a booklet refuting a lot of the claims in Liam Deasy's book, and it's a shame that both of these men who were Republican, took the anti-treaty side, fought throughout the Civil War for the Irregulars, as they were called, the anti-treaty IRA, and ended up, towards the end of their lives, engaged in quite a nasty public dispute. Now, Liam Deasy's book was published not long before his death, and Tom actually wrote a letter to the paper at the time refuting a lot of those claims, I believe. And it got quite nasty, and Liam died fairly soon after, so we didn't get a chance to hear his rebuttal. But putting all of that aside, I'm going to take the accounts from both of those books. In later episodes, we can start dissecting them, because Liam Deasy's book doesn't mention the false surrender, which was a part of the engagement where the Oxys, three of them, threw up their hands and put down their rifles and said, "We surrender," which led to, depending on the account, between 2 and 3 of the volunteers coming out of cover, at which point the Oxys pulled their sidearms, the revolver, and opened fire. Now, I think I covered this in a previous podcast, but in a couple of different accounts from Tom over the years, from newspaper articles and all the rest of it, he contradicts himself slightly in when some of the men actually died. Some were killed during the engagement itself, during the ambush, and some were killed during the false surrender. But whether it was 2 or 3 killed in the false surrender, the controversy really stems from, was there a false surrender? Did those men actually surrender, and did Tom Barry command his column to keep firing on them? Or, in his account, which I'll read now, Tom said after those men had opened fire after the false surrender, they tried to surrender again, and Tom Barry wouldn't accept the surrender and told him to keep firing, his own men to keep firing. Now, people will think, these men surrendered, should they have been taken prisoner? Another person might think, why would they be taken prisoner? Would the volunteers have been given the same treatment if they were captured? And I think we saw in Clonmult not long after that those who surrendered from the volunteers were executed, some on the spot. And I will do a podcast on Clonmult fairly soon. And others will say then, did it really matter in the scale of the engagement if they'd surrendered or not? Because Tom said himself he had picked a position to kill Michael to make sure that there was no surrender. They either died fighting the Oxys or the Oxys died fighting them. Drill amidst the dead. As soon as the signal was received, the order, "Lie flat and keep your heads down until firing commences," was given twice. Then around the entrance bend, unconscious of the enemy behind him, riding on a sidecar pulled by a grey horse, came 5 fully armed IRA. These men should have reached the flying column on the previous Sunday, but failed to receive the mobilisation order in time. Now, as well as endangering their own lives, they very nearly upset the operation and endangered the whole column, for nobody could foresee the consequences if the auxiliaries had come on them at the entrance to the ambuscade. Luckily, there was a ditchless lane leading to the house, and immediately the order was given. "Gallop up the lanes! The Oxys are here! Gallop! Gallop!" The grey horse galloped, and in 30 seconds the small party disappeared from sight and were not to reappear until after the fight was over. 15 seconds later, the first lorry came around the bend into the ambush position at a fairly fast speed. For 50 yards, it was maintained its speed, and then the driver, apparently observing the uniformed figure, gradually slowed it down until, at 50 yards from the command post, It looked as if it was about to stop. But it still came on slowly, and as it reached 35 yards from the small stone wall, the Mills bomb was thrown, an automatic barked, and a whistle blew. The bomb sailed through the air to land in the driver's seat of the uncovered lorry. As it exploded, the rifle shots rang out. The lorry lurched drunkenly, but still came unimpelled by its own weight. The footbrake no longer pressed as the driver was dead. On it came, the auxiliaries firing their revolvers at the IRA who were pouring lead into them, and then the lorry stopped a few yards from the small stone wall. Some of the auxiliaries now fighting from the road, and the fight became a hand-to-hand one. Revolvers were used at point-blank range, and at times rifle butts replaced rifle shots. So close were the combatants that in one instance the pumping blood from an auxiliary severed artery struck one attacker full in the mouth before the auxiliary hit the ground. The auxiliaries were cursing and yelling as they fought, but the IRA were tight-lipped as ruthlessly and coldly they outfought them. It was not possible to see the efforts of the IRA except those near me. There, Jim Spud Murphy, John Flyer Nighan, and Mick O'Herlihy were fighting splendidly. Once I got a side glimpse of Flyer's bayonet being driven through an auxiliary, whom I had thought dead as I passed him, but who had risen to fire and missed me at 4 yards range. There was no surrender called by those auxiliaries, and in less than 5 minutes they had been exterminated. All 9 auxiliaries were dead or dying, sprawled around the road near the little stone wall, except the driver and another who, with the life smashed out of them, were huddled in the front of the lorry. At the opening of the tack, I had seen the second lorry come around the entrance bend, but did not know of the progress of the action at that part of the road. Now that we had finished with the first lot, we could see the second lorry stopped 30 yards at our side of number 2 section. The auxiliaries were lying in small groups on the road firing back at number 2 section, at about 25 yards range. Some men of number 2 were engaging them. Waiting only to reload revolvers and pick up an auxiliary's rifle and some clips of ammunition, the 3 riflemen from the command post, Murphy, Nighan and O'Herlihy, were called on to attack the second party from the rear. In single file, we ran crouched up to the side of the road. We had gone about 50 yards when we heard the auxiliary shout, "We surrender!" We kept running along the grass edge of the road as they repeated the surrender cry and actually saw some auxiliaries throw away their rifles. Firing stopped, but we continued, still unobserved, to jog towards them. Then we saw 3 of our comrades in number 2 section stand up, 1 crouched and 2 upright. Suddenly, the auxiliaries were firing again with revolvers. One of our 3 men spun around before he fell, and Pat Deasy staggered before he, too, went down. When this occurred, we had reached a point about 25 yards behind the enemy party, and we dropped down as I gave the order. "Rapid fire, and do not stop until I tell you." The 4 rifles opened a rapid fire, and several of the enemy were hit before they realised they were being attacked from the rear. 2 got to their feet and commenced to run back past number 2 section, but both were knocked down. Some of the survivors of a number 2 section had again joined in, and the enemy sandwiched between the 2 fires were again shouting, "We surrender." Having seen more than enough of their surrender tactics, I shouted the order, "Keep firing on them. Keep firing, number 2 section. Everybody keep firing on them until they cease fire." The small IRA group on the road was now standing up, firing as they advanced to within 10 yards of the auxiliaries. Then the ceasefire was given, and there was an uncanny silence as the sound of the last shot died away. I ran the short distance to where I'd seen our men fall and scrambled up the rocky height. Michael McCarthy, Dunmanway, and Jim O'Sullivan, Nakoradra, Rossmore, lay dead, and a few yards away, Pat Deasy was dying. As we bandaged him, his face grew pale, but he was quite conscious as I spoke. "They're all dead, Pat. We will move you to safety, to a house in a few minutes, and we will get a doctor. Are you in pain?" He smiled as he replied, "No, Commandant, but give me water." I knew enough first aid to understand that any liquid might quickly kill him, so he was told he would get a cup of tea when he reached the house. I turned away and ordered all the survivors, except the 2 who were to remain with Pat, to get down to the road. The whistle blew, and the order, "Fall in at the double," was given. Down the road with rifles at the trail came the insurance party of 6 riflemen. Out from behind their rocks doubled Stephen O'Neill and his men, and from behind their high positions slithered number 1 section, hastening to join the others. After numbering off, they reloaded. 4 men were sent hurrying for a door to bear Pat Deasy away. 6 were ordered to protection positions. 18 detailed to remove the armament and papers from the dead auxiliaries, and the remainder to make the lorries ready for burning. The first unarmed scout to reach the scene of the fight hurried for a priest and a doctor. The other two collected the personal effects of Michael McCarthy and Jim O'Sullivan and made preparations for the removal of the bodies of those gallant comrades. Within 7 or 8 minutes, Pat Deasy was borne away and the flying column fell in with its task completed. 18 men carried the captured equipment over their own, the enemy rifles slung across their backs. One man had a sandbag full of the auxiliary's papers and notebooks. Jack Hennessy of Ballineen, whose head wound had to be dressed, reported his fitness to march. He was told to remain sitting on the roadside until the column moved. The flying column came to attention, sloped arms, and was inspected. Some showed the strain of the ordeal through which they had passed, and a few appeared at the point of collapse because of shock. It was of supreme importance that those men should be jerked back to their former efficiency, particularly as another engagement with the British might well occur during the retirement. They were harshly reprimanded, and then the column commenced to drill and march. The lorries were now ablaze. Like two huge torches, they lit up the countryside and the corpse-strewn, blood-stained road as the flying column marched up and down, halted, drilled, and marched again between them. For 5 minutes, the eerie drill continued until the column halted in front of the rock where Michael McCarthy and Jim O'Sullivan lay. There it executed the present arms as its farewell tribute to those fine Irish soldiers. The column formed sections and the order of march was given. A half an hour after the opening of the fight, it moved away to the south, aiming to cross the Bandon River before the British held Manch Bridge. Soon it commenced to rain again and the men were drenched. The rain continued as the IRA moved back through Shanachashel, Clognagow, Baltinbrack, and arrived at the vicinity of the dangerous Manch Bridge. With full precautions, the Bandon River was crossed, and Greenore, 11 miles south of Kilmichael, was reached at 11 p.m. On the road back, I had decided that the column could not be risked in numerous billets that night as was usual. Hourly, the threat to it would develop as the British sought it out and endeavoured to surround it. The column would have to remain together in a single house, ready for instant action. Paddy O'Brien and Dan Howren had reported an empty labourer's cottage at Greenore, and it was in front of this column halted. The local Balnacarraga company had been mobilised before our arrival, and the members were eagerly waiting to help. They posted an outer ring of scouts, provided candles, bread, butter, buckets of tea, and placed bundles of straw on the floor. They dumped the surplus rifles and equipment. All ammunition, bombs and revolvers were distributed to the flying column. It was now 1 a.m. and the scouts and sentries were inspected. When I returned half an hour later, the men were all sleeping in their wet clothes on the straw-covered floors. I looked at them and a thrill of pride ran through me as I thought that no army in the world could ever have more uncomplaining men. They had been practically 30 hours without food, marched 26 miles, were soaked through, nearly frozen on exposed rocks, and had undergone a terrifying baptism of fire. Their discipline was of the finest. Compulsion or punishments were not required for any of this volunteer army. They risked their lives and uncomplainingly suffered. I poked out a corner near the door and lay on the straw. I could not sleep as my mind worked rapidly. Lying on my back, staring at the ceiling of the dimly lit kitchen, thoughts crowded in on me. The auxiliaries had it. They were looking for it for a long time. They were now smashed, and their reign of terror against West Cork men and women was ended. The IRA had outfought them, and not more than 15 or 16 of our riflemen had had the opportunity to fire of them because of their dispositions. The super force. Who was this Colonel Craik who had commanded them and who now lay dead on the road? Close quarter fighting did not suit them. It does not suit the Essex or the Tans. Keep close to them should be our motto, for generally they must be better shots than us because of their opportunities for practice and their war experience. There are no good or bad shots at 10 yards range. Our dead. Two of them might be alive now had I warned them of the bogus surrender trick, which is as old as war itself. Why did I not warn them? I could not think of everything. Liam will be cut up, but he will understand. Pat will come. What will Mick and Jim's people say? War means death to some and can't happen without debts. The Oxy's paid though. Could we have managed 3 lorries of them? A good enough haul, 18 rifles, 1,800 rounds, 30 revolvers and ammunition, and the Mills bombs. They were badly wanted. We are well armed now. I must sleep. If they find us before day and come on us from the north, we will have to. I must sleep. I must sleep as I want to be fresh when they come. Someday they will surround us. Sleep. Sleep. So that was Tom Barry's account there, and incredibly vivid. And on the Instagram page at Rebel Tales Podcast, I'm going to put up a video of the ambush site that I took on the anniversary, the 101st anniversary of the Kilmichael ambush on the 28th of November. And that was last year I took these videos. It was a rain-soaked day, quite like the one that they would have endured during the ambush. So that'll give you a sense of what the entire area looks like. Now, it's lush and green now and beautiful trees and a lovely rest area. But back then it was barren. There was no coverage. They were quite exposed where they were. And now moving on to Liam Deasy's book. There's an account in it, but it's from Paddy O'Brien, because Liam Deasy himself wasn't actually at Kilmichael. But his brother Pat Deasy was, the 16-year-old who sadly died. And this book, this account of the Kilmichael ambush, I think was one of the main sources of information for Peter Hart, the Canadian historian who wrote The IRA and Its Enemies. And I think that was one of the first books to really question if there was a false surrender. But to start here, we paraded at 5 a.m. on Sunday morning, and after a breakfast of tea, bread and butter, we set out on the 5 mile march to Kilmichael. It was raining heavily, and it was so dark that you could not see the man in front of you. When we reached Glown Cross, it was still very dark, and we were soaked through. We met people going to Mass, and they were ordered to return home for their own safety, and for ours also. It was just coming daylight when we reached Kilmichael, and without more ado, Tom Barry divided the column into two sections, taking charge of one section himself, and placing the other section under the command of Michael McCarthy. Positions selected on the previous evening were taken up, and I was given orders to maintain contact with the different units while immediate preparations were being made. I went first to help Michael McCarthy. We rolled down the stones to within 2 yards of the verge of the road and built a low barricade there and camouflaged it with forest brush. Thereupon McCarthy posted some of his men behind it. Ned Young was placed southwest of the road, and Michael Con O'Driscoll was stationed at the most northerly point, from which he had a very clear view of the road and could give a timely signal of the approach of the enemy. Having completed my round, I returned to the first position inside the low fence where John O'Hearn and Batty Coughlin were stationed. In the adjoining laneway stood Tom Barry, Sonny Dave Crowley, Jim Spud Murphy, Mick Hurley, and John Flyer Nine. Higher up and overlooking this position were Tim O'Connell, Ger Cotter, Mick O'Donovan, and some others. Shortly afterwards, I crossed the road to the spot where Stephen O'Neill and Jack Hegarty were lying opposite the first position. Further on, I met Paddy McCarthy and Jack O'Sullivan, who were on a higher point overlooking the second position. We had two official scouts from the locality, namely Tim O'Sullivan and Jack Kelly of Johnstone. The brother of the former was busy during the day bringing buckets of tea to the men, and oh, very welcome they were too, as the long hours dragged on. Time seemed to move slowly, yet in spite of the tense air of expectancy, spirits were still high, though here and there a pale face glimpsed through the shifting mist reflected the inner fears of a youth facing the ordeal of battle for the first time, and the possibility of death. The early winter night was beginning to fall and light to fade when a signal from Michael Con O'Driscoll was given. The enemy was coming. All weariness vanished. The quiet talk ceased. Safety catches were released. Rifle bolts were drawn and a bullet filled the breach. In these last moments before the battle, there was an extraordinary distraction. Along the road from Glown came a pony and a trap with four armed men right into the middle of the ambush position. This was enough to upset the whole plan and even bring disaster in its wake. The problem of removing the untimely intruders gave rise to a crisis. Never on the dramatic stage was a transformation scene carried out with such dispatch, nor, indeed, with such efficiency. A sharp order directed the new arrivals to gallop the pony and trap up the lanes to Murray's yard. Even as it reached the lane, the first Crossley tender appeared in view. Tom Barry had placed a stone on the road, and had ordered that when the tender reached it, fire was to be opened. The opening fusillade killed the driver instantaneously, and the tender came to a halt. Barry appeared on the road and threw a hand grenade into the back of the tender, and all was over as far as that one was concerned. When Stephen O'Neill and I came out onto the road from the opposite side, we found Flyer and Spud were at the first tender. All the occupants had been killed. Meanwhile, the second tender was about 150 yards behind and had become stuck in the side of the road where the driver had unsuccessfully tried to turn it. The auxiliaries had jumped out, threw themselves in the road and were firing from the cover of the tender. We then opened fire from the rear, and when they realised that they were caught between two fires, they knew they were doomed. It was then realised that three of our men had been killed in Michael McCarthy's section, he himself being shot through the head, Jim O'Sullivan through the jaw, and Pat Deasy had two bullet wounds through the body. Two others had been wounded, Jack Hennessy and John Lorden, but though they had lost a great deal of blood, their wounds were not serious. It had been a short but grim fight. Of the 18 auxiliaries involved, one escaped and fled across the country only to be captured and shot later, and another was taken for dead, survived for a while but never recovered from the wounds. The remaining 16 had been killed outright. The fight was over. We proceeded to collect the arms left by the enemy, 17 rifles and revolvers, together with ammunition and equipment. The two tenders were then set on fire, and the volunteers prepared to withdraw as soon as they had laid the dead auxiliaries by the roadside. The spoils were divided out amongst the men, and as darkness fell, we left Kilmichael and set out on our long march of 14 miles to Greenore. So there are a couple of differences between that account by Paddy O'Brien and from Tom Barry's account, and later on then from other men's accounts, those who were there at Kilmichael. But to consider too, putting aside Civil War politics and all of the other factors, it was getting dark. These men were hungry, they hadn't eaten, they had travelled all night, they had waited all day, their clothes were frozen, almost solid, from the rain and the cold. It was getting dark, and there must have been incredible amounts of confusion, but also to mix in the human element of fear. A lot of these men were just farmers, they were labourers, they'd never held a gun before, outside training. And here they were taking on the auxiliaries, that even though they were called cadets, that was only because they were cadets to the Royal Irish Constabulary. These were commissioned officers in the British Army during the First World War. They weren't fresh to fight. They were battle hardened, and 17 of them died that day, at the hands of really only 16 men who had rifles of fire, out of the 46 of that column. Which is an incredible testament to the bravery of those men. And in the next podcast, I'm going to go into the accounts of that false surrender and a couple of the other fallouts from the Kilmichael ambush. But I think it's important to never take away from the bravery of those ordinary men, what they risked, how it could have gone the other way, like happened in the Clonmult ambush, which is often referred to as Kilmichael in reverse, where the entire IRA section was wiped out by the British in that engagement. But I hope that this episode was able to give you some idea of what really went on there from an official point of view in the excerpt from Eve Morrison's book, but also from the men who were there. And I would definitely encourage you to go onto YouTube and take a look at some of the interviews by Tom Barry in the column later on in life. They did a special in the late 1960s, I think, for RTE called 7 Days, where a lot of the surviving members of that column were interviewed. Now they were old men at this stage, but there's some great stuff in that. And Tom Barry was giving interviews right up to his 80s. And a lot of that footage still exists. And some great footage too of Dan Breen from Tipperary. If you're into this, these are incredible resources to understand that time in Irish history. So I'll be back with part two of Kilmichael. There'll be a bonus episode in between. If you like this, please do consider leaving a review, and please do consider following me on at Rebel Tales Podcast on Instagram. I'll be posting a lot of resources, including pictures and videos of the Kilmichael area. And until next time, thank you for listening to Rebel Tales.